You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson in for Bob Ferret. Coming up, fears of a recession loom as the novel coronavirus outbreak continues. We'll talk to a policy analyst about how Wisconsin could weather the possible economic downturn. First, Brandon Taylor was a biomedical researcher at the University of Wisconsin-Madison before leaving the field to become a writer and editor. His debut novel, Real Life, follows Wallace, a young black and queer man from the South trying to get his footing as a graduate student in a mostly white Midwest college town. Throughout the book, the protagonist navigates his relationships with colleagues, friends, and a love interest, while also feeling increasingly isolated. The novel has been getting glowing reviews, with O, the Oprah magazine, calling it a blistering coming-of-age story. Brandon Taylor talked with Central Time executive producer Judith Sears-Poisson about his work.
Your main character, Wallace, is black, gay, and from the South. And the feeling of being on the outside looking in as a grad student in Madison is really palpable. How much of that is from your own experiences?
Much of it, in fact. I was a graduate student here from about 2013 to 2017, and, you know, it was a difficult time. I mean, it was also a great time. It was really beautiful. The city, I mean, Madison's a great place to be a young person and to kind of figure that out. But graduate school itself is like a fairly precarious time. So I spent a lot of time feeling kind of lonely and on the edge of things.
And my sense of Wallace is that he has a really deep emotional well, but he's really closed that off for most of his life. And when he starts allowing himself to have some feelings, a lot of others come rushing to the surface. Is that how he felt to you?
Yeah, I mean, I in writing Wallace, I was interested in trying to explore a character who had a great deal of feeling and who was really sensitive and alert to the world, but who, for various reasons of self-preservation, had kind of closed that off. And I wanted to explore what happens when that dam begins to break and to sort of chart not only the feelings of the moment, but like that long lifetime history of all the buried stuff that he just didn't let himself feel just to survive it, you know. And so that certainly was a part of the motivating energy of the novel for me as I was writing it.
It seems like the past traumas that Wallace deals with give him feelings of worthlessness and that he's not as lovable as many of his peers, and many of his peers being white people. I think that's something that so many of us can relate to.
Yeah, I think that the culture teaches us all things about ourselves and ways we internalize narratives about worthiness. And I think we all do, in fact, go around feeling like other people have it better. Other people their life is so easy. And it's because we only have like the surface level of like what's going on in their lives. And we don't know that the people that we love most often, in fact, also feel these feelings of unworthiness. And I think part of that is just because, you know, we live in a world of surfaces and projections, and we live in a world where we're always trying to put forward our best image. But, you know, when you're sort of at home alone, you're really thinking about all the mess of your life. And I think the novel kind of charts what happens in a friend group when we don't really know people as well as we think we do.
And those relationships are always inherently messy. And then you put on the layer of, you know, flirting and relationships and, you know, is this person really my friend? Is this person really interested in me romantically or not? It gets really complicated.
Yeah, but that as a writer is one of my most, that's one of the things I'm most interested in, is like the inherent messiness of human connection and human relation. And you know, like when you're a grad student, you're trying to figure out so many things about your life and like love lives and like dating within programs. It's always such a fraught space. And so that was just like a really rich place for me as a storyteller. I just had a lot of fun teasing out, you know, all of the various conflicting agendas and does he like me? Does he not like me? Are these people my friends? Are they not my friends? I just find that just like such a rich space as a writer.
Wallace is a graduate student, as we've been talking about. His work is in biochemistry, and he's studying and running experiments on a particular type of worm. He and others in the book comment on how they are not suited to life in the real world. And I have to say, even going back to my own graduate school experiences, it is such a pressure cooker and social bubble that you are in with these people, especially I was in the humanities, but in a lab environment, you are around these people for many hours a day. They are often also your social group. I mean, it is a really kind of unnatural social environment. And I actually couldn't help but think that Wallace and his colleagues, his friends, weren't that far removed from these worms that he was raising in this very rarefied environment.
Oh, that's kind of an amazing comparison. I hadn't quite thought about that, but I mean, certainly, I think that there is something about academia because it is kind of a petri dish in a way, right?
Like
it's this isolated social setting where the media is like very closely regulated. The conditions are very closely regulated because you're trying to turn young minds into like brilliant researchers in a field, you know. I kind of love that comparison because they are like little organisms under close observation.
Well, and there's also this weird inherent competitiveness when you are trying to be the top in your field or one of the best or at least recognized, and there are so few positions that you might actually be able to get into. So while they are the people closest to you, they are also your biggest competition.
Yeah, and I think that also just extends to the nature of like mentorship as well, because in essence, their mentors are training them to replace them at some point, but often the mentors don't actually want to retire. And so it's like this very weird environment where it's like very collegial and very supportive, but also they are such scarce resources that like if you stop to think about the material reality of it, it's like, oh, these people who are my dearest friends, they also are going to want jobs someday, and those are the same jobs that I want. And so I have to see them as like future competitors, mm-hmm. but also colleagues, but also peers, but also my dear friends. Like it's incredibly messy and really, really fraught.
We're talking with Brandon Taylor right now about his debut novel called Real Life, based on his own experiences as a graduate student here in Wisconsin. And there were aspects of your novel, Brandon, that reminded me of another recent debut novel by another African-American author. It's called Everywhere You Don't Belong by Gabriel Bump. And especially the aspect of never feeling quite at home, quite like you belong, no matter where you are or who you are with. I felt that in both of the books. In your experience, is that a challenge for many African-Americans, regardless of their sexual orientation?
I really love Gabriel Bump. We did an event together recently. He's just, he's so talented. You know, I do think that for many people of color, and speaking as an African-American myself, I do think that that is something that when I talk to my other black friends, that's something that comes up a lot. We talk a lot about feeling kind of both wanted in these spaces and also like very unwanted. And it's just like, it's incredibly difficult. It's a really challenging thing to navigate, you know, even progressive spaces as a person of color, because often these progressive spaces, as accepting and, you know, progressive and liberal as they are, they also sit upon a bedrock of, you know, like white fragility and like white supremacy. And so like it's difficult to navigate that. Even when people have such good intentions, sometimes those intentions come out in ways that are actually harmful and damaging. And with this book, I was really determined to write, you know, to write that nuanced reality, because it's not that people are bad or evil. It's just that it's hard to be a person in the world, mm-hmm. you know, like it's hard to make your intentions felt and known. And even when you do your best, sometimes it's not enough. And sometimes it does do harm. And I think that the novel kind of articulates that. Like it's trying to get at the fact that no one is perfect, no one is 100% right, and that when you live in a society, you participate in both doing harm and you are harmed by it.
while you did say that you were drawing in large part on your own experiences at school here in Madison, did writing through Wallace's eyes bring you any new insights into those experiences, kind of, you know, bringing the circle around?
I think so. You know, when I was writing the novel, I was revisiting some really quite negative experiences. And through writing, I came to understand kind of the other side, not to sort of pardon some of the things that were done to me or to excuse them, but I think I did come to a place of deeper understanding and empathy for those people. And I came to understand, you know, sort of how a person could think that what they were doing was right. And so, I think the novel did bring me, I don't say closure, but it did bring me some understanding. And that understanding, I think, was really helpful in understanding the place. And I think also in writing it, I came to understand that I actually really love Madison. It was an incredibly rich time in my life when I learned how to be an adult and how to be in the world. And it's a time that I wouldn't take back for anything. Like, I would never want to sort of erase it, even though some of my experiences were negative.
What kind of response have you gotten to real life so far?
I had really modest expectations for this novel because it's a very quiet novel about some scientists in Madison on a weekend. And I thought maybe some people would read it. But the response has been so generous and so moving. So many former scientists have read it and reached out to me and said that it felt so much like their own experiences. And so many of my dear friends in Madison who were part of my science cohort have read the novel and have just been so loving and full of support and kindness. And so it's been more than I could ever have imagined. It's just been so incredible.
And Brandon, what's next for you?
I'm finishing up edits on a short story collection that I think should be coming out next summer.
Well, we will look forward to that and to talking with you about it. Brandon, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
That was writer Brandon Taylor. He talked with Central Time executive producer Judith Sears-Poisson about his debut novel, Real Life. Coming up, we'll talk to a policy analyst about what the Wisconsin government learned from 2008's Great Recession and what it could mean as the state faces a possible economic downturn amid the novel coronavirus outbreak. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm John Munson. Coming up, as the coronavirus outbreak continues, many state and local governments have issued guidelines for residents to stay at home and practice social distancing. We'll talk to an epidemiologist about how effective these measures are and how much longer they might need to be in place. Now, in 2008, the United States faced one of the most significant economic downturns since the Great Depression and could soon face another big economic hit. At the height of the aptly named Great Recession, unemployment topped out at 10% in the United States, and economies around the world took years to recover. Fast forward to today, we don't have subprime mortgages fueling an economic downturn. Instead, mass layoffs and chilled consumer spending due to the spread of the novel coronavirus have stoked fears of another recession. A new report takes a look at what lessons Wisconsin learned from the Great Recession and how the state might weather a COVID-19-related downturn. Jason Stein is the research director for the Wisconsin Policy Forum. Jason, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you, John. Appreciate being here.
Before we get started, can you quickly give us an overview of how the factors that led to the Great Recession differ from what we might be seeing now?
Sure. I mean, they certainly have a similar amount of severity. The difference in the case of the Great Recession, there you had a financial crisis that was brought on by something really fundamentally wrong with the country, you know, certain types of toxic debt that, you know, sort of reverberated through the financial system. You know, here we had an economy that, at least to all appearances, was sound when this crisis struck. And really, the economic effects are downstream of public health decisions that people have made at the local, state, and federal level to try to minimize the harm to people's health. And so one of the challenges is that the kinds of typical things that the government would do to spur demand in the midst of a recession, like, you know, getting money into people's pockets, cutting taxes, things like that, you can get that to people, but they can't necessarily go out and spend it with restaurants that are hurting, with bars that are hurting, with hotels that are hurting, because those businesses have been shut down.
Well, let's go back to 2008. How was Wisconsin set for the downturn before the Great Recession? What kind of shape were we in going into that?
That's a nice framing question, John. In the run-up to the Great Recession, Wisconsin was arguably one of the least prepared states in the country, particularly when you looked at our short-term reserves. So whether you were looking at our general fund, which that is the main set of accounts for the state of Wisconsin that pays for health care for the needy, school aids, universities, prisons, things like that, we had very little in the way of cash reserves in the general fund. We're among the worst states in the country, less than 1% of annual spending. When you looked at our unemployment fund, that was also unprepared for even a moderate recession, let alone the really serious recession that we saw in 2008 and 2009. And so the good news is that today, and we can talk about it, we are at least better positioned.
Okay, so we're a few weeks into what seems to be a slowing economy. That may be an optimistic view of it. At what point will we know if we've hit an actual recession here in Wisconsin?
I mean, you know, the traditional definition of a recession is the economy contracting for two calendar quarters. You know, I mean, I think we can sort of set aside the technical definition of it and just look at, we have seen people go on to the unemployment system making initial claims in numbers that we have never seen in data in Wisconsin going back to the 1980s and going back to the national level decades further than that. So we know that we are seeing, at least in the speed of it, an economic shock that is truly unusual and truly serious.
With that in mind, how is Wisconsin situated to weather an economic downturn due to this coronavirus outbreak?
Sure. So, I mean, the good news is we're in much better shape than we were in 2007. I mean, the unemployment insurance fund, you know, had roughly $2 billion in it in 2019. That is, depending on how you measure it, 2.5 or 3 times more than we had in 2007. So that's the good news. And the same with the general fund. The general fund has, you know, roughly 10% of spending nearly, which is, again, an order of magnitude bigger than in 2007. That's the good news. The bad news is we're still, you know, no better probably than the average state. Our unemployment fund on one key measure of solvency ranks maybe 30th nationally. We're also sort of in the middle of the pack for our general fund. So although we're much better shape than we were in the past, we're still really in the middle of the pack for other states, and this is something that is going to wallop every state, you know, really hard. So I don't want to leave listeners with the impression that there won't be a lot of pain and difficult choices, because there will be.
Jason Stein is the research director for the Wisconsin Policy Forum. He's with us to talk about the health of the state's economy and how it could weather a potential coronavirus-related recession. What economic factors, Jason, could hit Wisconsin's coffers particularly hard if the outbreak continues on its current trajectory? You mentioned unemployment. What else would be a problem?
You know, local government relies a lot on the property tax, which is much more stable. State government, really all the major taxes for state government will take a hit here. You know, income tax, as you see people laid off of their jobs, they're not going to have income taxes withheld from their paychecks. So that'll take a hit. You look at restaurants, bars, hotels, so many of the businesses that were forced to shutter collect sales taxes, whereas some of the other things like grocery stores where we go and buy food, you don't have sales taxes collected on that. So that takes a hit. Corporate taxes, corporate profits are going to be hurt. Those will go down. Gas taxes, people that aren't going to drive as much, those are going to go down. So you're going to really see impacts to state revenues really, you know, across the board.
Senator Tammy Baldwin is going to be on our show tomorrow to talk about the $2 trillion stimulus package passed last week in Washington. What impact could this stimulus have on Wisconsin's economy, and does it go far enough?
I mean, one thing that's really difficult in assessing whether it goes far enough, how hard we'll be hit, is what is the length of this? Again, if you were to say tomorrow that all of this could come off and we could return to normal, the impact is way different than if it lasts for weeks and months, which seems more likely right now. So that's one challenge. That $2 billion piece of – a trillion, excuse me – dollar piece of legislation has help for all kinds of entities in Wisconsin. So it has additional unemployment benefits. It has direct payout to individuals and families. It has aid to small businesses. It has aid to state and local governments to the tune of roughly $2.2 billion. So there's a wide variety of things that it does that will provide assistance and help to businesses and individuals that are hurt through really no fault of their own. I think it remains to be seen, though, whether it's enough.
Well, that we'll be watching this and seeing what transpires. Thank you very much, Jason, for being with us today.
Oh, it's my pleasure, John. Thank you for having me.
Jason Stein is the research director for the Wisconsin Policy Forum. He joined us today to talk about the fiscal health of Wisconsin as fears mount of a potential coronavirus-related recession. Coming up, we'll continue our conversation about the novel coronavirus outbreak, notably how effective measures such as social distancing and safer at home have been slowing the spread of the disease. That's all coming up on Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson in for Rob Ferret.
First, growing old can be tough, and women may face particular challenges. Ageism, bias against older women, loss of loved ones, health concerns, it's easy to think of the downsides of getting older. But our next guest says old age can be a time of happiness, gratitude, and contentment for women, and there are ways to make aging more positive, even in the midst of the bad stuff. Mary Pfeiffer is a psychologist specializing in women, trauma, and the effects of our culture on mental health. She's the author of 10 books, including her latest. It's called Women Rowing North, Navigating Life's Currents and Flourishing as We Age. Mary, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
Well, you focus on a lot of the positives of aging in your book, and we'll spend a lot of our time on that. That said, you don't ignore some of the realities. What are some of the difficulties women face in particular as they age?
Well, I talk about the joys of and sorrows of this life stage being as mixed together as sea salt and water. And that's what I think makes it such a catalytic stage for growth. But among the sorrows, most of us start losing people as we age. Many of us lose some loss of functioning in some way that affects what we can do. For example, I no longer backpack up mountains or go ice skating, even though those were things I really enjoyed at one point in my life. And also we are more likely to deal with things like loneliness as we age and our friends move or move on in terms of where they live and so on. So I think there's a lot of challenges, including one great challenge is ageism. And in fact, I think ageism is actually a bigger problem for women than aging, because ageism is really about cultural scripts that are very limiting to women in terms of their own understanding of how much potential they have to grow in this life stage.
talk about ageism and the roles that we as a culture assign, the limiting roles that we as a culture assign to older women.
Well, it's a funny thing, Rob. When I wrote this book, I tell people, well, I'm writing a book about older women. And the women I told would either say, you're not old, or I'm not old. But nobody wanted to say anybody was old. And it's because being old is such a toxic word in this culture, and it's associated with so many bad ideas. You know, I mean, the sort of the general stereotype of older women is, for example, portrayed with mother-in-law jokes that were kind of old, useless, grumpy in the way. And a lot of the way the culture defines old age is by our limits, that we're not as sexy or we're not as attractive or we're not as productive, we're not in the workforce or we're not raising children. And in fact, as I looked around me at older women, and I'm 71, I'm in this life stage too, I realized that's actually not the story at all, that women are the happiest people in the American population, women over 65. And when I talk to my women friends, many of them are saying, this is my favorite life stage. And there's a lot of reasons for that, but one of them is that we've had, in many cases, 7 decades to learn to be resilient people and to develop the kind of life skills that allow us to just be grateful and happy and have reasonable expectations so that we're primed for happier lives because of our internal architecture and our coping skills.
Talking to Mary Pfeiffer, she's a psychologist and author of the new book, Women Rowing North, Navigating Life's Currents and Flourishing as We Age. You talk about that metaphor in your title in the book, Mary. You're not recommending that older women drift with the current. You want them to row and navigate. You're making the case, I think, that women have some control over their happiness through the choices they make.
Absolutely. I think that the challenge of this life stage is, with all of its perils, to cultivate resilient responses to whatever it is we face. And the way to do that is by intention and attitude. And intention is basically deciding that we're going to have a certain kind of lives. We're going to look in a certain direction for our happiness. We're going to build good days for ourselves. We're going to find meaning and purpose and things to enjoy. And then attitude is just making a really very conscious or existential decision that we've got everything we need to be happy, and that we're going to focus on those thoughts and behaviors and attitudes that make us happy. So I think a lot of us end up, by the time we're 70, having the potential to do that. And, you know, another thing that's really important to this life stage is we're starting to be aware that the runway is short. And one of the things we know about research from older people is that the shorter the distance you perceive to be between the current moment and your death, the more likely you are to find your life meaningful and full of pleasure. And that's what starts happening. You start being so grateful for these beautiful little experiences. In fact, one of the sort of things I think by now is there really isn't such a thing as a small pleasure. What happens, I think, for many people as they get older is everything becomes something to be really savored and enjoyed.
Right now we're talking to Mary Pfeiffer about the experience of growing old as a woman and how to navigate happiness. She's a psychologist specializing in women. Her new book is called Women Rowing North, Navigating Life's Currents and Flourishing as We Age. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Is this your story? If you're middle-aged or older, what's your experience been with aging? Have you found more happiness or contentment as you get older? Are there things that work for you, even in the midst of some challenges, that to help you find happiness with your life? Do you think society gets aging wrong? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll go to your calls now. Marcia is with us in Madison. Marcia, hi.
Hello. How are you?
Good. What did you want to tell us about, Marcia?
Well, first, I very much appreciate the book, but I have a circle of friends, and we met, and we were talking about this very subject yesterday. And one of the things we decided is that I think every generation needs to know that we've been through so much that we can become very compassionate people. And so we're probably the best ones when younger generations have troubles to come tell us about it, because we probably have been there and done it.
Marcia, thank you so much for sharing that conversation you had with your friends. Mary, what do you think of that, finding compassion in aging and using that and using that life experience to help younger people?
I think Marcia's absolutely right. And one of the great gifts of old age is a growth in empathy and moral imagination. And so we're likely to have compassion, and we're also likely to have a lot of stories that we can tell that are teaching stories about things that have happened to us over the course of our lifetime that might be useful to younger people. The other thing I feel is really important is in this society, we segregate people so much by age. And it's a sad injustice to all of us, because each life stage has its own kind of loving, its own kind of energy and skills. And so when we can put together older people with younger people, really good things happen. Really good things happen.
Marcia, thanks for that call. And Mary, Marcia reminds me of another chapter in your book about finding community. It sounds like she's done that pretty well. Talk about the importance of finding, maybe recreating community as we age.
Well, I talk about that in a lot of ways. But one thing I mention in the book, I have a chapter on it, in fact, is women friends. And as we get older, I think we're extremely fortunate if we have women friends, and it's never too late to make them friends. But they become sort of our emotional health insurance policies and do a lot of supporting and nurturing us. If we're really lucky, we have friends we've had for 5 decades, but that isn't something that happens to everyone. So that's an important community. The other thing is I think it's really great to be involved in one's neighborhood as some kind of advocate or activist or volunteer, because these meaningful activities give us reason to be alive. And the saddest old people I've met are people who kind of feel like, well, I don't really have any purpose here on earth. I think having a purpose is important to most people as having oxygen. And so it's very good to be engaged in community.
Let's bring on another caller now at 800-642-1234. Jane is with us in Grafton. Jane, hello.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I am so excited because just last night somebody told me to read her book. So I can't wait to
thank you.
Yeah, she said it was really good. And I tell everybody, just like you are, that it's terrific to be old. I'm 72, and I love it. I tutor dyslexic kids. I'm very involved with my grandchildren, and I sing at a barbershop chorus that gives me tons of emotional support. And I think it's true. I wouldn't trade this time of my life for anything. I find it easier to love and to forgive, find joy in the silliest of things. I love it.
Jane, thank you so much for sharing that. A lot there for us to talk about, Mary. Easier to love and forgive, Jane says.
Well, I think that's true. And including, I think we start having a real sense of self-acceptance. A lot of women are pretty hard on themselves and give themselves a pretty hard time and second-guess themselves and feel guilty. And it seems like this is the last stage where we start to really extend mercy to ourselves as well as the rest of the world. You know, there's a lot of gifts of this life stage. And Jane is a bit, she sounds happy, doesn't she? Her voice sounds happy. And one of them is authenticity and the ability to just be who we are and do what we want to do and say what we want to say. And that's a great thing. Another gift is sort of being able to take the long view of life and keep things in perspective. And, for example, I knew my great-grandmother, and I'm likely to live long enough to know my great-grandchildren. So when I have family issues and things come up, I've got 7 generations of family that I can think about in terms of putting things into perspective. And it's just, it's really wonderful. And the other thing I want to mention, it's very common with older people, is they start having more experiences of bliss and more epiphanies. And I think partly that's because we slow down. It's really hard to experience bliss if you're always in a hurry and if you're always crossing things off the to-do list. But at the point you can start really slowing down and sitting and having a cup of coffee and watching the sunrise. Or my favorite thing is I love to go out and lie under the stars at night in the summer and just look at the sky. You start having more moments when you just feel like, I'm really truly happy and feel so lucky to be alive. And that's something I think that ironically comes with age.
Thanks so much for that call. We'll go next to Darlene with us in Tomahawk. Darlene, hello.
Hello. I just turned 93 on the last day of January, and it's interesting to hear these 72-year-olds saying that they're getting old. But anyway, a couple of things. One is that my best friend since second grade is still alive, and we say we're so happy we remember who we are, and we can remember things to talk about and enjoy that. The other little skill that I don't know if you say it's a skill, but the other thing that I like to do is if I sit and feel that I'm alone too often or too long a time, I think, well, just think where you've been and the things you've done. So I start making a little list of the places I've seen and visited and events that have happened, and it kind of lifts my spirits, and I get to thinking of something good.
Darlene, thank you so much. Happy birthday. Mary, sorry, go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say Darlene's a really good example of happiness being a skill and a choice. And, you know, at 93, what she wants to tell the world on this phone call is, I've got a great best friend that I've had from second grade I truly enjoy, and here's something I do to cheer myself up. And she really exemplifies what I'm saying about older women, is that we both tend to make that choice to be happy and then have the skill set we need to assure that will happen.
Darlene, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. We're talking to Mary Pfeiffer. Her new book is called Women Rowing North, Navigating Life's Currents and Flourishing as We Age. It does sound like a skill that she had, learning to take those sad moments and use her life experience to boost her spirits. Mary, can you talk about, I guess, skill building for aging if we don't have that skill, if we're succumbing to the downsides of aging? How do we start to turn the craft around?
Well, of course, first of all, none of us have that skill all the time. And speaking for myself, I'm not a naturally sunny person. And my lessons about happiness have been hard earned. And in fact, I think it'd be hard to write this book if I'd always been a real sunny person. Because what happens, I think, is as you grow older, you really start to figure out what works and how to make life workable. So that, for example, as you're aging, things happen all the time that you have to adapt to. And one of the real tricks of aging is that you keep adapting and that you keep finding workarounds and that you devise possibilities for yourself of self-rescue no matter what. And one thing I argue in the book is that as you're walking out of a friend's funeral, you learn the capacity to look overhead and hear the wild geese and see the wild geese and taste snow on your tongue. You figure out that gratitude's a survival skill, that there's always something you can do. You can look for evidence of love in the universe. You can look for beauty. You can look within yourself for your inner resources. And really, you have everything you need to be happy within yourself.
You mentioned, Mary, younger women being hard on themselves, and you give examples of that through the book. Is there a way we can translate what older women have learned, you know, maybe by age 65 or 70, and help bring that to the younger women so they don't have to wait so long to get there?
Well, I think that's a great question. And I've actually been, I've been on a book tour, so I've been hitting bookstores. And actually, a young woman stood up and asked that question at one of my bookstores. And the room just kind of laughed because I don't know a way to do that. I mean, I think of my daughter, who's a wonderful, resilient woman. But she's 41, and she's in the workforce, and she has two little kids. And like a lot of young families, she and her husband are struggling with money. And I think she's slowly learning the skills she needs to learn to be calm and happy and resilient. But I think it's a lifelong process. And I think that's one of the things, this culture, when it talks about old age, talks about diminishment. And in fact, there's a totally different and much more interesting and complicated story under that, which is actually as you grow, not everyone grows. We all suffer, but we don't grow. And there's certain people that really have stayed stagnant because they haven't seen the opportunities, they've resisted or been fearful of every opportunity for growth that's come their way. But that's a very small group of people. And as we move forward and grow, we start gaining this inner strength that allows this to happen. And, I mean, I think, of course, there's 40-year-olds who know everything I know about being happy, and there's 90-year-olds that don't know much about being happy. But I think just the fact that we're around for 7 decades gives us some perspective and some life experience that you can't have at 40 years old.
We have time for one more caller. I think Stephanie is with us in Madison. Stephanie, hi.
Hi there. I just turned 69, and I'm also blind. Where I have to use a cane. I've slowly lost my vision. I'm having to learn a whole bunch of new things. And I think what I'm learning is I don't want to be miserable. Okay. I want to be a person that other people want to be with. And so it's realizing that we're all interdependent. There's no absolute. We don't really absolutely know what the future is going to hold. So I try to face new experiences with being open to what kind of experiences I can have and kind of getting my ego out of it and being in the present, being as mindful as I possibly can be.
Stephanie, thanks so much for calling. Mary, in our last minute or so, your thoughts on what Stephanie had to say.
Well, I think she's on her way. I mean, Stephanie, I really congratulate you for attitude. I mean, it's really clear that you have the attitude and the intention to be happy and to use a very old-fashioned phrase to make the best of it. And my guess is you will be able to. And, you know, the book doesn't argue that anybody has the capacity to be happy all the time. I mean, that would be a ridiculous argument. But what I do argue in the book very strongly is that with good attitude and intention, we can be happier and we can find ways to make every day better. And I can tell you're going to do that. You know, I have a lot of hope for you. And one of the things this book gave me was a great deal of respect and hope for all older people, and also the desire to start a new cultural conversation about this life stage, because the current conversation we have is really an inadequate conversation, and it's limiting the potential of the members of this culture who are over 65 to grow. And that's not only unfortunate for our generation, it's unfortunate for the culture.
It's a good place to leave it, Mary. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you. I enjoyed it, Rob. Goodbye.
That's Mary Pfeiffer, psychologist specializing in women, trauma, and the effects of our culture on mental health. We've been talking about her latest book. It's called Women Rowing North, Navigating Life's Currents and Flourishing as We Age.